TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Dangers from Drugs Manufactured Overseas, with Catherine Eben, author of Bottle of Lies. Catherine Eben's recent book, Bottle of Lies, reveals that nearly 80% of the active ingredients of all brand name and generic drugs, as well as almost all of the antibiotics in the U.S., are made outside the country, mostly in China and India. Eben is an investigative journalist. She has written award-winning stories that range from pharmaceutical counterfeiting to gun trafficking. Bottle of Lies is a New York Times bestseller that came out in 2019. On June 17, 2020, Catherine Eben gave a talk for TEDMED. That's a series of TED Talks that focus on health and medicine.
In 2008, I got an unusual phone call from a guy named Joe Graydon. Joe said he was getting flooded with complaints from patients who'd recently been switched to generic drugs. Joe was a trained pharmacologist and co-host of a radio show on NPR. Patient after patient said their generics were causing unwelcome side effects or even relapses. Joe believed the patient's claims. But when he reported these complaints to the FDA, officials there argued it was probably psychosomatic. Patients are upset by pills that look different from their old ones. Joe didn't buy it. He wanted someone with investigative firepower to dig into this. And since I was an investigative journalist, he called me. And then he posed a question that I couldn't get out of my head. Catherine, what is wrong with the drugs? I spent the next 10 years trying to track down the answer. Our healthcare system relies on generics. My family does too. But a decade of interviews, meetings with whistleblowers, on the ground reporting across four continents, and thousands of confidential files from the FDA, from generic drug companies, and from the courts, all pointed me in the same direction. A large number of generic drug manufacturers in certain overseas countries are passing off substandard drugs as legitimate generics for profit. They are deliberately flouting FDA regulations and standards. Basically, they are committing fraud. In the process, they are risking the health of patients around the world. They may even be costing patient lives. One leading company in India has already shut down because of this activity. I wanted to know, was that company an outlier or the tip of the iceberg? What I uncovered is disquieting, and anyone who takes generic drugs has the right to be deeply concerned. If you're skeptical about any of this, that's fair. I saw generics as one of the world's great public health innovations, a giant win for patients worldwide. 90% of our drugs today are generic. I knew generic HIV/AIDS medicine had saved many lives in Africa. Here at home, programs from Medicare to Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act depended on them. In an overpriced drug market, generics were the heroic underdog. But my biggest assumption was based on the FDA's reassurance that properly regulated generic drugs are not only safe and effective, but bioequivalent, interchangeable with the brand and with one another. Well, that's true. If companies follow the rules on paper. But inside far-flung drug plants, I uncovered a different, unwritten set of rules. I started my investigation by focusing on the regulatory framework. Right away, one fact surprised me. The FDA does not vet manufacturer applications by testing the drugs. Instead, it reviews company data. As the FDA's generic drugs director actually told me, the approval system requires the ethical behavior of the applicant. Otherwise, the whole house of cards will fall down. Really? It's the honor system? Oh. After 9 months of digging, I published my first article on generics. I wrote about patients who'd been switched to generic drugs and suffered medical setbacks. I quoted doctors who questioned whether generics really were bioequivalent to the brand. A month later, I got an anonymous email from someone calling himself $4 refill. $4 is what you'd pay to fill a generic prescription at Walmart. $4 refill worked inside the generic drug industry. He said, if I really wanted to uncover the problem, I'd better go look where the majority of our generic drugs are made, in India and China. $4 refill was right. 80% of the plants making the active ingredient for all our drugs, brand or generic, are overseas, mostly in China and India. Any generic drug company anywhere in the world wanting approval to sell its drugs into our market has to follow elaborate rules known as good manufacturing practices. I decided to learn every detail of how to manufacture a legitimate generic drug. At a top New Jersey lab, I watched as technicians ran tests on specialized machines and used flasks that mimic stomach conditions to measure drug dissolution. But one remarkable fact jumped out. The lab banned whiteout, correction fluid, across its facility. Under FDA rules, data serves as the cornerstone of quality. It has to be gathered at each manufacturing step, preserved, and shared with regulators. Whiteout was high risk. It invited tampering. It was clear that for the FDA's regulatory regime to succeed, any company applying for approval had to be ethical, and its data had to be unaltered. But what if neither was true? What if the applicant was not ethical? What if the data was not pristine? I started to hear about a company in India called Rambaxi, India's largest drug company, one of its first successful multinationals, and one of the fastest growing generic suppliers to the US market. A whistleblower was supplying internal Rambaxi documents to the FDA. I got copies. Deciphering the company's charts, graphs, and numbers unveiled a shocking swindle. They substituted unapproved lower purity ingredients. They invented documents like standard operating procedures, steaming them overnight in a sauna-like room to make them look old. They conjured up 3, 6, 9, and 18-month stability studies, all generated on the same day. Gradually, I was able to unearth the story behind this regulatory nightmare. In 2004, Rambaxi hired a new research and development director. He suspected something was amiss. He ordered a young engineer named Dinesh Thakkar to study the data in every drug application to find out if it was real or fake. Tucker eventually put together a devastating PowerPoint showing Rimbaxy had falsified data for over 200 products in more than 40 countries. The new R&D director showed this PowerPoint to a subcommittee of the board of directors. The subcommittee ordered the report and the laptop on which it was created destroyed. Then they forced Tucker out of the company. Tucker couldn't sleep, thinking about Rimbaxy's perilously bad drugs. So he risked his life to alert the FDA. After an 8-year investigation, Rimbaxy pled guilty to 7 felonies for faking data. An FDA consultant taught me that just like cheap clothing made in distant factories, or fast fashion as she called it, there were fast drugs too, made in pharmaceutical sweatshops overseas with low quality ingredients and manufacturing shortcuts. In Mexico City, I sat in a bar with a whistleblower. He handed me documents revealing how the cost-cutting generic drug plant where he worked had knowingly released drug batches that contained glass particles. In Accra, capital of Ghana, doctors explained how low-cost Indian and Chinese medicine of all kinds barely seemed to work, even when they doubled and tripled the doses. In Mumbai, I met another whistleblower from a company that I had believed was ethical. He sat there and described the well-oiled machinery of data manipulation his company used to get compromised drugs approved fast. With tears running down his cheeks, he said, "What's going on in the industry is very, very, very dirty." In the US, a confidential source who worked in the government handed me a thumb drive containing over 20,000 internal FDA documents. The emails and memos revealed how the agency's public health mission, protecting consumers, often clashed with its political mission, showing Congress a steady stream of low-cost drug approvals. I also learned about the FDA's compromised inspection system for overseas drug plants. In the US, FDA investigators arrive unannounced to do surprise inspections. But overseas, the FDA gives manufacturing plants months of advance notice. It asks for the company's help arranging ground transportation and hotels. My sources also talked about staged inspections, where teams of data fabricators invent or alter needed documents to create a facade of compliance long before the FDA arrives. One intrepid FDA investigator named Peter Baker figured out how to find the truth. He ignored the data printouts, and he looked inside company computers. When files were deleted, he found metadata revealing hidden tests. The companies were pre-screening their drugs, figuring how to alter the official tests so they would meet FDA specifications. As I said, this problem is more than a handful of bad actors. Over 4 years, Peter Baker inspected 86 plants in India and China. He found evidence of fraud in 67 of them. Wonder what happens to a batch of drugs that fails testing? It should get thrown out. Instead, low-cost plants usually sell them into poorly regulated markets that don't realize what they're getting. Places like Africa, Southeast Asia, and India itself. The overseas generics industry calls this dual-track production. Better drugs for some, failed drugs for others. in the developing world, this corrupt system has flooded the market with so many bad drugs that public health researchers link them to the rise of drug-resistant infections. But criminal behavior by overseas companies is only half the problem. Though some regulators apparently don't realize they're being conned, in the US, our regulators appear willing to overlook transgressions in order to continue greenlighting low-cost medicine. As a result, some American patients have gotten generic drugs with toxic impurities, unapproved ingredients, dangerous particulates, or that are not bioequivalent. As the FDA investigator Peter Baker put it, if people actually understood, then nobody would take these drugs. Are there ways to solve this global problem? Yes, there are. Solutions begin with recognizing that our current honor system for drug regulation is a relic of a bygone age. Science evolves, medicine evolves, the global economy evolves. Shouldn't regulation evolve with them? Only one approach can guarantee quality generics: rigorous oversight, including unannounced inspections and systematic testing of drugs. Rigorous oversight means that regulators don't just look at printouts of data that may or may not be genuine. Effective solutions also depend on giving the average patient more information. We know where our breakfast cereal and our running shoes are manufactured. Why is it different for generic drugs? Patients can do something else. They can tell their elected officials and consumer organizations to speak up just as loudly to demand quality as they do to demand access. Consumer organizations can do their members a great service by testing and ranking generics, just like cars and washing machines. The big pharmacy chains owe it to the public to test the drugs they dispense. A trip to the pharmacy for affordable medicine shouldn't come with a hidden cost. Now is the time for all of us who care about patient safety to act on what we know. Thank you.
That was Catherine Eben's talk for TEDMED from June 17, 2020. TEDMED's mission is to connect science and the public by sharing stories that inform, inspire, engage, and provoke action. Thanks to TEDMED for giving access to their programs. Next up, here are excerpts from a one-hour interview with Catherine Eben by Ken Ford and Don Kernagas of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, IHMC. They spoke with Catherine Eben in March 2020 about the dangers associated with relying on generic drugs manufactured overseas. Here's Ken Ford.
Suppose someone is listening to this interview and just, you know, happens to wander into their local pharmacy and tells their pharmacist that they really don't want the generic version of a drug that their physician has prescribed. How is the pharmacist likely to react?
Since the book's come out, I've gotten every imaginable reaction from pharmacists to very sympathetic, I knew it all along, that there was something wrong with these drugs, to you're scaring patients who don't have any other choice but to take these drugs. So I think the reaction could be a number of things, but what the pharmacist could tell a patient is, we've had fewer complaints on this generic than that generic, or you might be able to get what's called an authorized generic, which is after the brand goes off patent, some brand companies will continue making the exact same drug under a generic label for a generic price. So, you know, there's a variety of ways to address the problem of a patient feeling like they don't want to be on a certain generic anymore.
So do you think that this is a problem that's being driven by insurance companies?
Driven might be a strong word, but it's definitely part of the issue, which is insurance companies are driving us all to take lower cost medicine. Most insurance companies will refuse to cover a brand drug if a generic is available. So maybe driven is fair.
When you first started working on the story in 2009, generic drugs made up about 60% of the nation's drug supply. By the time you published Bottle of Lies, roughly 10 years later, generics made up over 90%, or roughly 90% of the supply. Could you explain what caused this abrupt spike?
You know, I'm not sure if it's an abrupt spike. I mean, what we've seen really since, 2004 is this steady, steady climb of generics. By that year, 2004, the FDA had more manufacturing plants to inspect overseas than in the U.S. Generic drug manufacturing was being moved overseas, either by Western companies or by Indian or Chinese companies that were entering our markets. Drug prices kept climbing, so everybody was looking for an affordable alternative. And so basically every year we've seen this dramatic increase in the percentage of generic drugs that we are using in the marketplace.
So one of the more colorful characters in your book is Peter Baker, a young FDA investigator. I'm interested about his story about how he ended up in New Delhi looking into Indian drug manufacturers.
Yeah, so Peter Baker, he grew up in a Mennonite family in Oregon, but he was a traveler and a wanderer and a chemist. He had tattoos on his arms from his motorcycle group, so maybe not your typical chemist. And he got hired by the FDA to be an investigator. And when they started looking for volunteers to relocate overseas, and particularly to India, his impression was, well, the Indians are such experts in aseptic manufacturing, which is the very exacting science of creating sterile drug products, that if he took this gig overseas, he'd learn from the best, he'd have relevant experience when he returned home, and so he took the job. He starts inspecting these plants, and there's a fundamental problem with FDA's inspections overseas. So in the U.S., the FDA investigators arrive unannounced at manufacturing plants in order to inspect them, which makes perfect sense. But overseas, the system is different. Because of the difficulty with logistics and visas, they give these manufacturing plants months of advance notice. So what Peter Baker understood was happening is that the companies were essentially staging their inspections. Prior to Peter Baker's arrival on the scene, a lot of FDA investigators would just sit in a conference room and ask for printouts of data. So Peter Baker started looking directly inside the computer systems of these plants, and that is how he figured out what was going on. He found metadata where he found traces of the hidden and deleted tests. Over the course of 4 years, Peter Baker inspected 86 drug plants in India and China, and he found evidence of fraud in 67 of them, four-fifths.
It's amazing. So when Peter or any other FDA investigator finds contamination, what happens next?
So provided that the FDA investigators are good enough that they can really document convincingly what is going on in these plants, then they send a recommendation back to FDA headquarters. And the recommendation is there's no problem, which is NAI, no action indicated. The next would be VAI, which is voluntary action indicated. That means the plant has problems. Here's what we found. The plant needs to fix them. And the most serious is OAI, which is official action indicated. That means this plant is a serious risk. Immediate action is needed. And if the plant can't take sufficient corrective action, we're going to restrict the flow of drugs from these plants. But what was happening back at FDA headquarters, and this is one of the things I expose in the book, that as the investigators are sending back recommendations of OAI, the FDA bureaucrats are downgrading those recommendations. They're saying, well, I know you think it's serious and you were in the plant, but we don't think it's that serious. So we're going to call it VAI instead. And the downgrades of Indian plants were hugely significant. They ranked over a certain period of years, they ranked in the over 100. And in the same time period, the downgrades in the U.S. were one.
That is amazing.
Amazing. So one of the most compelling examples in the book is Peter's investigation into the Wockhardt plant. Can you share what happened there?
Peter Baker was sent to inspect a Wockhardt. It was a sterile manufacturing plant. They're making injectable cardiac drugs for the U.S. market. They know he's coming. They try to prepare. But, you know, when Peter Baker walks into a plant, he's very hard to prepare for, because he's not following any of their instructions. He's not taking a guided tour. He's not having a welcome reception. He's not having a slideshow. He's going where he wants, and he's looking where he wants. And he's walking down a hallway, and he sees an employee who is walking toward him down this long hallway but doesn't see him yet. And the employee is carrying a clear garbage bag, like a recycling bag, full of documents. And Peter Baker and his colleague tell the man to stop, and the man sees them, turns, and starts speed walking in the opposite direction. What ensues is a low-speed chase through a sterile manufacturing plant, which is, you know, particularly ironic because in a sterile manufacturing plant, employees are trained to move very slowly so that they don't disrupt the unidirectional airflow, since that's part of the way that you, you know, shut down on the possibility of contaminants. And the man finally tosses the garbage bag under the stairs and takes off. And Peter retrieves the bag. And in it, he finds these torn batch records. And the batch records show that the plant knowingly released insulin vials that had metallic fragments in them. So this is potentially deadly. This could have absolutely killed patients. And he realizes, he follows the trail of these records. He realizes that there is a secret area of the plant where the company is actually doing its manufacturing for the U.S. market as well. And they haven't disclosed it. And there in that area of the plant, they're using the same corroded equipment that led to the metallic fragments in the insulin.
Wow.
Yeah. Huge. Huge. So that one was OAI, official action indicated, an import alert. And, you know, just so that your listeners understand, I mean, this is, that restriction on this plant was a $100 million loss for this plant, which is why this battle is going on. You know, I would say to you that Bottle of Lies is essentially a corporate crime thriller because it is about what is going on in the executive suites of these companies.
That was author and investigative journalist Catherine Eben referring to her book, Bottle of Lies, The Inside Story of the Generic Drug Boom, a New York Times bestseller that came out in 2019. Thanks to Ken Ford and Don Kernagas from the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, IHMC. This was a 12-minute excerpt of a one-hour conversation posted on the YouTube channel of the IHMC under STEM Talk. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.